Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. It is the Roguecast for Wednesday, August 5th, and we are fast approaching our 75th podcast.
Yes.
We really recorded almost 75 of these things?
We have.
That's crazy. That means there's like 75 hours out there.
Yeah, at least. Yeah.
There's no chance it can be used when I make my presidential run in a few years.
I wouldn't worry about it.
What could go wrong?
I want somebody to take you know that you can do that thing where you like take little
snippets.
Splices,
yeah,
so that you can make it say anything. If somebody does that, I'd be down with it.
Oh, I think you'd probably come up with some sentences out of this. Yeah, you probably would just lift them whole cloth out of the podcast. You wouldn't
have to. I don't think you need to be overly cautious. But
so yeah, the 75th podcast is coming up. It will be like triple sized because
it's an annual.
We reached out to all our former staffers and current staffers, and hopefully we'll have everybody on the podcast for a little bit.
Yeah,
talking about working at the store and their favorite pop culture stuff. And we'll have a big store announcement coming up in a few weeks. So
it's going to be super cool.
Stay tuned for that. In the meantime, next week, August 10th, is our ladies' night on Monday at Palermo's Italian.
Yay.
That next Tuesday, August 11th, is our Reading with Rogues with Through the Woods, also at Palermo's.
Yep.
And then the next Monday, August 17th, is Red Dragon Inn at Kirby Lane here in Round Rock.
Which, if you haven't played Red Dragon, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a game. It's the game of after you've all taken down the dragon or the dungeon or whatever, you go back to the bar and drink.
Yeah, and steal each other's money.
Yep.
And
what's the runtime on that game?
Actually pretty quick,
like 30 minutes, an hour.
I think around 45.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds like a good wind down game.
Yeah, I've seen it go longer because it is one you can expand to like have 12 people playing.
Right.
Yeah, but
I'd be doing the straightforward basic.
But in general, yeah, it's a quicker play game.
Yeah, yeah.
Then coming up September, just a couple things. The end of September, Saturday the 26th is our Batman Day, which we will have among other things. With any purchase, you get a free Batman Endgame Special Edition that is the first part of the Joker Batman story that Scott Snyder wrote.
We're talking about this. It's a good story.
Probably do a sale on Batman merchandise. We're talking to cosplayers about getting stuff in. So
yep.
Should be kind of a fun day. And then
you're going to come dressed as Batman, right?
No.
But I will say this. I feel certain that for the store's Spotify list, we're going to bring some Danny Elfman and animated series music into rotation.
Sure. Then that next Sunday, September 27th, is our pre-release for the Battle for Zendikar, the next Magic set. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's all the store news coming up. And then we have some other news for the week.
By the way, some of that store news can also be found on the newly redone whiteboard.
That's right.
Boy, it sure is a magical day when that has a new new face to it. I wonder who the talented person behind that is.
It's definitely not Dave.
I don't know.
Anyway, moving on.
All right, well, as long as Dave's tooting his own horn.
Well, the Star Pterodactyl does the board. What are you talking about?
I've talked about this podcast before. I think the RPG Randy Plays Games,
yes,
at oneofus.net. Well, I bring it up because I know a couple of the people who listen to this podcast have been wondering. We did one recently that was an all female cast playing Rat Queens in Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. The first episode of that went live yesterday, and I was pretty happy with it. Curtis Wiebe, the writer of Rat Queens, retweeted us.
Oh, that's really cool.
And
you posted it on the store's Facebook, right?
I did post it on the store's Facebook.
And I listened to it last night. It was a lot of fun.
It's really funny, and the girl we got playing Betty basically is Betty.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, they all did a really good job.
Yeah, everybody's very much in character.
And it's a lot of funny stuff.
It features Amanda here from one of the people in the store playing.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun. If you're a Rat Queens fan, I definitely recommend taking a listen.
I also think it's not a not bad as far as just like if you're kind of curious to see what Dungeons & Dragons is like.
Yeah.
This might be a slightly raunchier game than usual, but you can kind of hear the basic mechanics at work and get a sense for what's kind of fun about the new edition.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so then we've got some lot of role-playing game news that came out of Gen Con.
Right.
Dave and I are sort of lamenting this online that there's not like a Newsarama or comic book resources for games.
Right, as far as I was really looking for like a singular
like a rundown
that would have like sort of aggregate all the news that they would just have like here's, you know, here's the main releases from all the companies that were announced.
Yeah.
You know, here's the Kickstarters that are starting up. You know,
yeah.
The big news all in one place.
It seems like every other thing has something like that. Video games, comics, movies.
Yeah. But RPGs and board games, just, I mean, there's a lot of message boards. Like, Board Game Geek is an aggregate for that kind of thing.
We have some friends who pointed us to, there are good sites out there like EN World and a bunch of other ones that people have mentioned. But you got to still hunt and peck. It's kind of like trips to the forums.
Yeah.
I think if you're not familiar with the lay of the land there, you're not going to be able to find it fast.
Nobody's doing like that, like a news type stuff, like Comics Alliance or one of those. Nobody's doing that for games, it seems like. Or maybe we just don't know, but nobody seems to know about it if someone is.
Right. It was not – I did multiple Google searches of variants on Comic-Con 2015 – not Comic-Con, Gen Con 2015.
Yeah.
News, new releases and things like that. And I found I was only turning up little bits and pieces, dribs and drabs.
Yeah, same here. But we did get a bit of news. Pinnacle Games, who does a lot of the Savage World stuff, they announced three new RPGs.
Those guys seem to be flying high.
All using the Savage World system.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do Fear Agent, the sort of pulp sci-fi thing that Rick Remender did for Dark Horse.
Right.
They're going to do...
Who was the artist on that? It was the Walking Dead guy.
Jerome Opina and Tony Moore.
Yeah, Tony Moore just for at least the beginning.
And then The Goon, which was kind of weird as a role-playing game.
I missed that one, but yeah, that's kind of crazy.
And then Flash Gordon, which is very pulpy and fits with Savage Worlds, and it seems to be specifically the 80s movie Flash Gordon.
Oh, is it?
The logo certainly is.
Oh, can we get Max Van Sydow to come in and play Ming?
He's the one and only. You know, he's going to be on Game of Thrones now.
That's right, he's going to be the three-eyed crow.
I hate to say it, but when I saw that announcement, my first thought, Max von Sydow is alive?
You always say that.
And I'm always surprised.
Yeah.
He is still kicking. He's awesome.
He's an amazing guy, but he was old when I saw him in Dreamscape in 1984.
And he looked very old in Exorcist, I know, but that makeup, Dave. Makeup. He's actually like 20.
Actually, you know, that was the makeup on him in The Exorcist is one of the most amazing makeup jobs I've ever seen. I don't think I knew it was makeup until somebody told me.
Yeah.
He looks like, what is he like? He looks like he's 60 or 70 in it.
Yeah.
What was it, like 40 or something?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Max von Sydow has always been 60, really, in his heart. So.
I think so.
Then we have movie news. As we record this, by the time you hear it, situation may have changed. The Deadpool trailer is not out yet.
It is going to be premiered tonight on Conan O'Brien.
Okay, so it's premiering late on Tuesday. But they did put a trailer out for the trailer.
Right, it's a teaser for the trailer.
Which is basically a thing they do now. And it had Ryan Reynolds in the Deadpool costume talking about the Deadpool trailer.
Yeah,
right. And definitely doing what the series has already kind of done in some of their previous trailers, making fun of them for completely effing up his initial appearance.
Yeah.
Wolverine?
Yeah.
Wolverine
Origins. I'm kind of surprised they went that way, but it's good that they're acknowledging.
I think they know the audience.
They're really running with the red band thing, too.
Yeah, they are. There's a lot of cursing in it.
Yeah. I find it a little bit forced, personally.
You and I both hate Deadpool.
Yeah, but you know what the interesting thing is? Deadpool, the comic character, and I've read some bits and pieces that I've liked over the years. Certainly read Gail Simone's run.
Sure.
Which occasionally forces me to look at something, and every once in a while I have to grudgingly admit it's funny. the book is like PG-13 at tops for like 99% of all published Deadpool stories.
That's true, and the Deadpool Max run was not one of the best runs.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
So it's a little weird to me that they're going with the very R-rated thing, and I have a feeling it has a lot to do with the video game that came out that was had an R rating, and I think probably honestly was seen by more people than the comics.
Yeah.
Overall, you know, video games sell in the millions. Comics have hundreds of thousands if they're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think you may be right. Nick, what did you think of this teaser, since Dave and I both don't like Deadpool?
I thought it was fine. I think Ryan Reynolds is a perfect Deadpool, and I'm excited to see the Red Band trailer tonight, which is what it's going to be. I actually didn't see the teaser, the standalone teaser. I only saw it attached to the end of the FF trailer that I watched.
Okay.
And yeah, it was interesting to see.
It was the same Red Band.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was him talking about all that stuff. It was interesting to see it tacked on to the end of the Fantastic Four trailer.
I have a weird minor complaint that's really not a specific knock against this trailer. It's something I noticed in this. I was telling you about this, Randy, the other day. In this, and also in the Spider-Man movies, is it sounds weird to me when characters who are masked heroes
talk through the mask. Yeah.
And they, you know, obviously they include that sort of muffled sound effect.
Yeah.
And I feel like you could probably just say as a genre convention, just let them speak in their normal voice, because it sounds weird to me. It's like, it doesn't sound cool.
You don't want realism in your superhero movies?
I don't want, not that particular realism. You know,
I agree.
Marvel has always been very clever about finding exactly what realism is cool and what isn't.
I agree with you.
Now, this isn't a Marvel movie, but anyway, it's a minor complaint. It's not what I don't like about Deadpool.
You don't want everybody to talk like Bane in Dark Knight Rises?
Yes! Yes, Mr. Wayne. You have my permission to remove the muffling sound.
Other movie news, Battling Boy, which Nick and I both really like. Yeah. It's a Paul Pope book.
What was the spinoff of that?
Is Rise of Aurora West is coming out. Or is that the one that's out?
That's the one that came out. Yeah. Really, I don't think I've read Battling Boy, but I read Rise of Aurora West, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, they're good. It's a good little series. And it is getting what we assume is an animated movie.
I assume it would have to be an animated movie.
The guy who's
movie,
associated with it is an animator.
Yeah, because the guy they picked to direct is Patrick Osborne, a name I didn't know, but he's worked on some Disney stuff like Big Hero 6 and that kind of thing. Most notably, he directed The Short Feast.
Yes.
Which was in front of Big Hero 6 and is a great little animated short.
Oh, that's the one with the dog.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
So that gives me a little hope.
I heard that when you said that as The Short Feast. And I'm the short feast?
No.
The short feast.
Yes.
Well, and I think Battling Boy is sort of ripe for, you know, a great translation.
Sure.
Hugely fun action-adventure.
It's a bit of a, like, sort of a pulp futurism.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, at least
well,
what I've read.
The Aurora West is, he's actually, like, a god. You know, they get sent down.
He's still sort of a superhero. I mean, his dad's a god, but they play it like superheroes.
Well, they do. But he's sort of sent down to Earth or whatever sort of for his trials and tribulations.
They fight monsters in a city full of monsters. It's sort of semi-post-apocalyptic. It's it's very Paul Pope-ish.
Yeah.
Yep.
Has a kind of a lighter touch at times, but as I recall, goes a little bit dark at times.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I could see, like, you know, Big Hero 6 is not wildly removed from the stylizations.
No.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting. Also in the movie news, they are moving forward with a Dungeons & Dragons movie again.
Right? A friend of mine posted about it, and he's like, me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, we won't get fooled again.
I saw that exact post. I've seen several people like, not buying this.
Are Damon Wayans and Jeremy Irons reprising their roles?
They really tainted their brand name.
Tainted their brand name. And then they did that direct-to-video one on Sci-Fi that was like a sequel that I saw people saying, it was actually pretty good. And they were wrong. It was not actually pretty good.
And they did a pretty crappy job with the Dragonlance animated thing, too.
Yeah.
That was very cheaply done.
I forgot they dropped the ball on that one, too.
Wasn't like Thor Birch in there? Thor
Birch,
well,
yep.
And Jeremy Irons.
Yeah, Jeremy Irons was terrible in that movie.
And the guy who played it. Wasn't Jimmy Olsen from Lois and Clark?
Yes, Wayland.
He was the lead.
He was the lead, yeah.
That was Jimmy Olsen Mark II, because there was a first Jimmy Olsen in that series.
I don't know. It was terrible.
Anyway,
it's a terrible movie.
So here's the thing.
But we did get Beholders.
Fake-ass Beholders.
the writer on this is not somebody who I was, like, really enthused for either.
No, he wrote Conjuring 2 and Wrath of the Titans, so mostly he's done crappy sequels.
Conjuring 2 hasn't come out yet, I think.
Not yet.
Oh, is it not? Okay.
That's at least a movie that would potentially be on my radar, especially if James Wan directs it or one of his protege-type people. Right. Because he did the first one. So that movie at least has a decent pedigree there.
Wrath of the Titans, not so much.
Not so much. What was interesting, though, is that they're definitively setting this in the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, which is good.
Which is a good idea. That's a really fleshed-out D&D setting. It's very often been their maiden campaign.
See, that's the thing. Even if the movie's bad, if we get, say, Waterdeep out of it or the Sword Coast or something like that, there'll be some stuff to recommend. One of the failings of the original D&D movie was that it could have been any generic Beastmaster ripoff.
Yeah.
It did not feel D&D.
Right. So it could have been a Sci-Fi Channel movie.
Yeah, and it probably was someone else's script that they just said, let's make a Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, right.
So do you think, with it being Forgotten Realms, we're going to get...
Trist?
Here's what I would do.
Yeah?
I would have him in as the end teaser kind of thing.
I would do a badass scene with him where he, like, interacts with them.
That would be cool, too.
I would treat it like an RPG campaign. You don't want Drizzt and Elminster and all those guys to be the actors in it. You want them to be flavor.
Right.
You want them to show up for cool scenes, and I hope that's what they're thinking.
Yeah. You know what would be kind of cool is if, feel like the characters are, like, on the trail of something,
they need some information that only this shadowy guy can, you know, in this, what was the village, that ice?
Oh, yeah, 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 I know what you're talking
about. Wherever he comes from, or was living. They have to go there and get some information. They're pursued by bad guys, and this guy turns out to be a badass, and, you know, they help him fight off whoever's after them, and they get their information. Yep. But, you know, you get a cool scene with Drizzt.
Yep.
And then with obvious spin-off possibilities.
I mean, the thing is, it shouldn't be that hard to make a good Dungeon. It should be really easy to make a good Dungeon. The technology is there for the special effects, even on the cheap.
You need a strong story, but I think in the same way that the Marvel movies will take, you know, bits and pieces of Marvel comics, and they've crafted good movies out of them with the right amount of fan service so that, you know, in that, you know, in D&D terms, that would be, you know, include some kind of fun, weird creatures, you know, have an owl bear in there, have a beholder, stuff like that. Show a few spells that are, I mean, you know, use spells that are very completely out of D&D.
Yeah. Well, honestly, why not pick up from to do what Marvel does, take the current module, like the Rise of the Dragon Queen, and make that the spine of your story.
Yeah.
Why not use all the pre-existing material instead of...
And there's also just a ton of good writers that are fans of D&D that have lived that.
None of whom are working on this movie.
And, none of those. They should be approached.
As far as looking for resources, there's lots of great Forgotten Realms novels, along with lots of mediocre ones, I know, but... And there's some very good comics. The fun D&D ones that I read when I was like 13 or whatever, the DC ones, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons comics and the Forgotten Realms actual comic.
Yeah.
We're all decent comics and would be filled with ideas.
I'm mostly dreading this, to be honest, but I would love to be proven wrong.
Yes. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the cautiously pessimistic or right pessimistic. The only thing is you hope that they've at least learned something of a lesson.
Well, Hollywood is nothing if not smart about learning lessons.
You know, they may be better than our government. I don't know. But you know, we had all the Lord of the Rings movies as examples.
Yep.
And you've got Game of Thrones.
Yep.
I'm trying to think. D&D, I feel like, should be more fun and adventurous. You know, a little bit more Willow.
I was thinking 80s fantasy, Kroll, you know.
And all that stuff.
What's the one with the Lady Hawk?
Yeah,
that kind of stuff.
All those kind of things. A sense of humor is something that should have more than, say, the Lord of the Rings movies. Although that actually did have some humor.
On the other hand, Dungeons and Dragons, the original movie, they were trying to be goofy and look how stupid it was. So maybe overly serious wouldn't be the biggest problem they'd have.
The Lord of the Rings movies are actually not a bad overall example in the sense that...
I mean, they're kind of boring.
They brought in a lot of comedy... through Gimli, Merry and Pippin. Rain is just a hater.
I said kinda.
We're trying to make a point here, Rain.
Sorry, make a point.
I already made it. What else we got?
All right. This is on uncategorized news, but Uhura is going into space. Well, sort of.
Space-ish.
She's going to be on the... She's going on a national mission at age 82.
Yep.
Nichelle Nichols is going to be going on the... SOFIA, the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, a 747 holding a large telescope, so it'll be basically as high as possible in the air.
Is the 747 actually going? The telescope going to be somehow taking pictures while in motion? That'd be crazy.
I believe so. Yeah.
Or are they going to? Is it somehow going to get it into orbit? Like it releases it and then?
No, she says a massive telescope mounted inside a 747.
That's crazy. I don't even know how you would do that.
I don't know. I assume it's strapped on top with duct tape.
I would think that all the vibrations and stuff would make for bad telescoping. But I don't know. I assume they know what they're doing.
I don't know. What do I know? It's NASA.
It's a dude strapped onto a wing with a telescope.
NASA's pretty dang smart.
It's NASA. They got another room of people thinking stuff up, another room of people thinking more stuff up.
Thank you, Armageddon reference.
So happy that you got that.
Who was the... Was that actually Harry Stamper himself who said that?
Is it Harry Stamper?
Isn't that his character name?
Bruce Willis? That is Harry Stamper. Sir.
Oh, there you go.
Jeez, learn your lore, Randy.
I know, I feel bad.
Can anybody name the name of any other character in this?
No. I know Steve Buscemi had space.
Bear.
Bear was my Clark Duncan. Yep.
Yeah.
And Liv Tyler.
Right.
That was her name.
She played daughter. She played role of daughter.
Ben Affleck played daughter's boyfriend. Yeah. Space Madness was played by Steve Buscemi.
That's right.
Wacky Guy was played by Owen Wilson.
Yeah. I think we clearly know our Armageddon.
What were we originally talking about?
I don't remember. Nichelle Nichols going into space.
Nichelle Nichols. It's cool.
Presumably to blow up an asteroid.
Yeah. Anyway, it's cool.
That's her secret mission.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the Star Trek guys have, considering that a lot of them sort of were, didn't get a ton of great acting work afterwards, yeah, and they were sort of typecast, or they, yeah, just didn't get a ton of work, they, a lot of them have managed to find pretty cool careers.
Yeah. George Takei. George Takei's a great example, icon. Yeah.
Shatner has been able to find lots and lots of roles.
Nimoy
as well as
was most beloved.
Spoofing himself, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, and yeah, this is a super cool thing for Nichelle Nichols.
Even even Chekhov wound up having a big role on Babylon,
yeah,
5.
Yeah, he was a great villain.
So, yeah. Yeah, and then finally, a sad note, as everyone knows, Roddy Piper died.
Yeah, he was pretty young.
Yeah, he was in his late, early 60s. Early 60s.
And, what was it, a heart attack?
Yeah.
I think. I watched, somebody posted, I guess, like, on whatever the main wrestling show is now. I guess
WWE Raw?
I believe that is correct.
They had a little they had a tribute that they ran last night, and it was a really good tribute.
Yeah,
I like, because, you know, I watched wrestling in the 80s, not so much since then.
Yeah,
but that was kind of my time watching it.
Right,
but he was of course a famous heel. He was one of those guys, the original trash talkers.
Yep.
Actually, I'm sure the original trash talkers were in the 1950s, but anyway, he was one of the legendary ones.
Yeah,
and he had his Piper's Pit.
Yep.
He'd interview people and goad people and all that stuff.
Wore a kilt. Man wore a kilt.
He wore a kilt. Honestly, this tribute is kind of touching because, you know, they, you know, aside from showing some of his best of wrestling moments, like, who was the big guy in the 90s? Was it Steve Austin?
Yep.
They show a bit where Steve Austin came into the ring with him, and Piper slaps him. And this was a guy who, like, at the height of his powers.
Yeah.
Piper slaps him in the face. He returns the slap. And then they edit to a scene later on where they decide they like each other and they, like, crash some beers together and drink beer. but they actually, they played the bagpipes for it.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
They showed him, like, a picture of him in, like, well, it had to be, like, college or something like that. Actually, he apparently actually did play the bagpipes. And
oh, that's cool.
I guess that's kind of how, I don't know if that's how he came up with his bit.
Of course.
Wasn't he Canadian?
I don't really know.
He always sounded Canadian to me in They Live.
Well, I was going
to
say, that's what genre fans know him from, is he was the lead in They Live.
With a million quotable lines.
Yep.
You know what's funny? Like, I love They Live.
Oh, I absolutely love it. It's my second favorite John Carpenter movie.
It's, he, you know, the first part starts out a little oddly, I don't want to say oddly, but it's a little serious. You know,
yeah,
he's a blue-collar guy who's out of work.
Yep.
And there's weird stuff going on, and, you know, that there is this sense of some sort of conspiracy that's maybe unraveling around
him. It figures it'd be something like this.
And then, when he puts on the sunglasses,
yep,
when the world changes for him, it's like he flips into wrestler mode.
Yep.
He starts insulting people, calling the chick formaldehyde face.
Real effing ugly.
Yeah, and of course, and he has the classic bubblegum.
Yeah.
It's just like he became another person,
yeah,
when he knew it was time to kick some alien ass.
Yep, yeah.
But that is a great movie. It is very, sort of, it still has its, like, you know, prescience.
Yeah.
John Carpenter had a lot to say in that movie beyond just, you know,
how awesome are wrestlers?
How awesome are wrestlers? Or, like, you know, it's cool to do another alien invasion.
They just, yeah, do, like, a anniversary edition of the Blu-ray.
They did. They did. I think 30th
where,
anniversary.
Where I think Roddy Piper and
Keith
John
David?
Carpenter did,
oh, John
like,
Carpenter.
A... audio track.
I actually, much as I love They Live, I don't believe I own it, and I might need to go ahead and rectify that.
I think I need to as well. I heard this is kind of funny, that Roddy Piper on the commentary track says, he interrupts, like, the commentary when, like, the big reveal is happening,
yeah,
and says that there was something like this that actually occurred, like, in the 50s, and it turns out it was, like, some sort of notable hoax, like,
yeah,
sort of from, like, an Onion of its time,
sure,
or something like,
yeah,
that. And Carpenter, I think, is kind of like, well, what are you talking about? And I got the impression that Roddy Piper kind of bought into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, but, yeah, you know, obviously, for wrestling fans, a true legend, and for action movie fans, or just John Carpenter people,
yeah,
you know, one of the cool action heroes of the 80s.
Yeah, if you haven't seen They Live, go seek out the 30th anniversary Blu-ray.
Oh, and watch the, look up the little tribute that they did on Raw last night, because it was a cool tribute.
Yeah. All right, that about wraps up our news for this time. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about comics for the week. All right, we are talking comics for Wednesday, August 5th, and this is another week with not a lot of jumping on points. I've got one first issue in my stack.
Yeah.
But it's a good week.
Yeah, there are great second, third, fourth
and issues. There are a few first issues that I haven't gotten around to.
Are there a few first issues? I guess I didn't see very much this week. I've got one that I had a chance to read.
Dark Corridor.
No, there's a bunch of stuff up there.
No, man.
There's some.
Anyway, none of us picked a number one for our pick this week. Dave, what's your pick?
Are we all picking Marvel?
We all did have cheater picks. Yes, we're all picking Marvel.
That's interesting.
In fact, is everything we picked Marvel?
Yep, everything we picked is Marvel.
We have picks and cheater picks, all of which are Marvel.
Wow.
We are Marvel whores this week.
Mine is kind of an unusual pick this week. It's not what I would call a five-star comic, but it was a lot of fun for me. It was the newest issue of Groot,
yep,
which I have not even been following this book.
Just randomly pick it up.
But why did this comic appeal to you?
It has Silver Surfer in it.
Well, duh. Anything that has Silver Surfer definitely should appeal to you. By the way,
this is the kind of pick you get with Dave, because Nick and I tend to be pretty set on what we're going to read. Like, we follow previews. We know what we're going to read ahead of time.
Yeah.
Dave will definitely...
I'm often reading some weird shit.
Dave will sometimes be like, I'm going to read this, and find stuff that you and I might just overlook because we're like, I'm not reading that book.
That's true.
So this is a random gem.
He already showed me the pictures in this, and they're very pretty.
I don't know if this is the regular artist. It is Brian Kessinger.
I don't know,
but it's kind of there's a cartoony style that has a lot of sort of a Disney quality to it. Randy,
is the regular artist.
But look at the facial expressions.
Yeah, it's
that
nice.
He's able to
it's good.
I mean, it's good art overall. But like, especially Silver Surfer's got Dawn Greenwood, who is an Earth woman who effectively in the current Silver Surfer series is kind of like her Doctor Who companion.
Yeah, he's Doctor Who
companion. That was clearly the inspiration, I think, for the current Silver Surfer.
Absolutely.
And what I gather from this storyline, it is picking up on an ongoing story. Groot, somebody is trying to... there's like a bounty on him. Mm-hmm. And they've captured Rocket Raccoon to try and lure him into their trap. And so he's trying to, find Rocket and rescue him. And I'm gathering that's kind of been the last issue or two.
Mm-hmm.
And they stumble across Silver Surfer and his pal Dawn here. And they have a team up. They have space team up.
Very nice.
I was showing Nick, there's something kind of neat they do. Of course, Groot speaks in I Am Groot Speak.
Yep.
But one thing they do that's kind of neat is every once in a while he'll do a big I Am Groot that you see how they have a giant, mega giant font there. And there's a little sort of sepia imagery behind it. Like the letters themselves are almost like comic panels. And you can sort of see what he's talking about.
That's a really clever mechanic, actually. Yeah.
Later on he gets very upset and you see, look, it's him and Rocket is being taken from him. And he's upset. But anyway, they, there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek humor. You know, the humor that I gather is kind of part and parcel of this book. It's a little cartoony, not quite Scotty Young cartoony, but it's a little cartoony.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? They decide to team up, and there's some spoofing, a little bit of spoofing of Silver Surfer and his poetic soliloquizing. You know how he's always kind of starts talking about fate and destiny and stuff like that. And it's clearly Dawn kind of knows that that's a thing he does.
Does he have any other character aspects other than that, though? I mean,
who's Silver Surfer?
Yeah, Norn. Or is that just his one thing that he does?
In the current book, you know, he's got a little bit of a sense of humor sometimes. Okay. When Stan Lee was writing him, he was very much the kind of a warrior poet. Dan Slott's been writing the current book, and it's almost a little bit more like a serious Doctor Who character, like one of the doctors when they're a little bit more serious, but occasionally kind of quirky too.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on here. And because it's probably because he's in Groot's book, he's having a little bit more fun. But you know, one minor nice thing I thought as they're traveling the spaceways, look, it's the Acanti, the big space whales.
Oh, nice!
X-Men.
I haven't seen those in a while.
Yeah. And they're totally not enslaved by the brood they were in X-Men.
I thought they were extinct.
It's a whole pod of them. They seem to be doing all right.
That's good.
The interesting thing about this is, like, essentially the sort of what's some of the humor and also the drama of it is Silver Surfer is very, very talkative and loquacious.
Yeah.
Groot is Groot.
Yeah.
And so, and Dawn's kind of approach is that they may be sort of just what each other need at this point in their travels.
Right.
They sort of have an adventure together, which involves a trap set for the Silver Surfer by an alien race. they get lured into, and you know, it inadvertently ends up being something that helps Groot on his quest. But it has really beautiful art throughout. It's a kind of a fun, lighter adventure story, and I think anybody could walk into this issue without really needing to know anything else.
Cool.
So that is my pick of the week.
Nick, what is your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is the third issue of the Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows, which is a Secret Wars tie-in.
Yep.
You know,
has he renewed his vows yet?
Yes. do it every issue. No, and you know, this is Secret Wars. It's continually being our picks, it seems.
Did we mentioned this at some point, right? That this is basically the an alternate timeline where Spider-Man is still married to Mary Jane. They have a daughter. An 8-year-old daughter named Annie Marie?
Annie May.
Annie May, right. Annie May, that's what I meant.
And I think we may have mentioned it in passing. I don't think we ever picked it.
I don't know
mainly
if we did either.
Because I think the first issue was kind of lackluster.
I liked the first issue, but it was a slower issue.
It was a slower issue. I did enjoy it, but the second issue sort of is where it picked up for me. And
well, it's got a weird premise, because it's not just like Spider-Man fighting crime. He retired, and there's this bad guy, Regent, he's basically taken over the world.
He basically kills and takes powers.
Yeah, he's stolen superpowers from everybody.
From everybody. And there are no superheroes left, or very few.
And Spidey's retired, and he has to hide his daughter's power.
Yeah, and it's sort of this kind of thing of what he has to do to in order to keep his family safe, where Regent is also sort of giving some villains more notable power-ups and things like that. So you have
his shock troops of the Sinister Six.
Yeah, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah.
But slowly we've seen sort of the old Peter Parker resurface.
As always, Peter's responsibility pushes at him. Because honestly,
Dan Slott is writing this.
Slott is writing it. The smart thing for Peter to do is to stay undercover with his family and stay safe.
Right. But
that is the smart thing to do.
Great power comes great responsibility.
But it's also a boring comic to read if that was what
exactly.
He did. So.
But
he breaks out his black costume.
He does, which I think is really, really cool.
Yep.
And also is in kind of a service, because in this world, Venom is still Venom. It's still Eddie Brock, and it's sort of very lethal.
Yeah.
And him using the black costume is kind of a little darker, but it's great. I love that Dan Slott is using some of like the smaller villains, like the Tinkerer.
Yep.
And
there are several characters in the Secret Wars books in general that are smaller guys, smaller heroes, smaller villains, kind of getting their due.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Hey, let's raid the back catalog.
What I like is like I think one of the sort of weird downsides I think of a good book like Suicide Squad, I think the misread some people got on it back in the day was, hey, wouldn't it be cool to take these lesser-known characters and kill them?
Yeah.
You know, happened in The Punisher, too.
Yeah.
Or not Punisher, but Scourge.
Yeah.
Did it. And actually, there were some Punisher stories where he killed B-list villains.
Yeah,
where
they just clean house. Yeah.
Well, the second issue of this actually used the Power Pack to great effect.
Yeah, Power Pack was great.
And I thought that was a phenomenal usage of those characters.
Yep.
This one, I think, really kind of grabbed me because one scene in particular having to deal with Mary Jane and her daughter.
That was a great scene.
And sort of talking about what Peter did as a superhero, because they don't talk about it. They're not allowed to talk about it to keep her safe. And just sort of, you know, what he did and why he did it. And it's just a very kind
sort of
telling, touching scene.
It was.
And, you know, I'm not going to spoil the punchline because it is really, really good.
Yeah.
Who's the artist on that, by the way?
This is Adam Kubert. So,
okay. You know what? From a distance, it looked a little bit like Joe Quesada when he's doing his
I think that's the nod. I mean, Quesada famously did the One More Day story that everybody hates. And this is sort of the antidote.
Right. Yeah, it is. And you still get sort of Peter's wit, but there is sort of a darkness to Peter in this world as well.
Also, the Annie May stuff is reminds me of sort of what I like about things like Miss Marvel or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Runaways. I think my daughter's going to like this book because it's an 8-year-old acting like an 8, much as I love Molly in Runaways.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be like 12 and she talks like a 6-year-old. And it drives my daughter crazy.
Yeah.
Because she loves Molly, but she's like, is she mentally damaged? Because she's like, that's not any 12-year-old I've ever seen.
Right.
And Slott actually.
I think I always thought she was younger than.
Yeah.
And then occasionally I'd be reminded by like, oh,
yeah.
Weird.
Their 8-year-old, Annie May is like an 8-year-old girl.
Very much so.
She's a little older.
And there's also some cool just villain stuff.
Yep.
The Sinister Six also has one of my favorite villains, Kraven the Hunter.
Yep.
And way he uses sort of like his tracking abilities. I like when they utilize their powers in fun ways instead of just kind of base stuff.
Right, right. Well, this is why sometimes when I see, like, a video game or something where you're fighting a bad guy or just see, like, Batman and Arkham Knight, and I'm like, oh, they're really thinking of some cool new stuff.
Yeah.
And the comic guys sometimes crawl up their butt a little bit with, like, let's draw, get even deeper into his psyche and peel back another layer, and I'm like, don't forget, sometimes you want to make these guys cool and just showcase the cool action.
And at the same time, sometimes they just take for granted because, yeah, we can see Spider-Man web-sling and all that kind of stuff that's still cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's something that Secret Wars has been good at doing is showcasing characters like that. Sort of, like you said, giving them their due.
Yeah.
Yep. But that is my pick. I really, really am enjoying this story. More and more with every issue.
Me too. It's one that I wasn't super into the first issue, but as it goes on, I'm definitely digging it as well.
How long is it running?
Five issues? Six? Somewhere in that ballpark?
They're also using the Prowler. I mean, come on. Yeah. The Prowler's awesome.
Yep.
what you got?
Randy.
All right, so my pick of this week is Ms. Marvel number 17, which is actually part two of a storyline. It's the last days of Ms. Marvel, although we still have part one. But the reason I picked it is because this is the long-awaited team-up of Ms. Marvel and her super idol, Captain Marvel. and it is as much fun as you'd imagine. Ms. Marvel is fangirling out. Captain Marvel is trying to be the good mentor. But the two of them sort of have a team-up. They're trying to deal with sort of a smaller local issue in the middle of this world-ending thing that was the beginning of Secret Wars.
Right.
So in the middle of the world-ending, Ms. Marvel's just trying to keep her friends and family safe and deal with sort of the micro stuff. While Captain Marvel's explaining her that as a hero, they sometimes have to deal with the macro stuff. And there's a scene here where she has to make a choice against, you know, save some people or save other people.
That sounds like a pretty potent story or, you know, a concept to drop in
there. Yeah, there's some serious – I mean, she's looking for her brother. It is a serious story. There's some serious elements going on. But it also is all the fun of Ms. Marvel fangirling out about Captain Marvel.
She finally gets to meet her
idol. Captain Marvel being kind of a badass as always. The art is stunning by Adrian Alfona. I love the art on this. There's a shot about four pages in where Captain Marvel's flying and Ms. Marvel is stretching and they're running over the sort of the rioting in the streets. And he has drawn all these locations and buildings and crowds, and it's just a really beautiful looking piece.
I love Alfona's work, and I love every artist who's worked on this book.
Yeah.
Kenshin Miyazawa.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is beautiful.
My only gripe is that the costume they use for Ms. Marvel is her, like, stealth uniform or whatever. It's like gray and black.
It was what she was wearing during that version of Avengers.
I know, and I hate it because it's it's black and white. It looks weird, and she's got her stupid mohawk helmet on.
That's so stupid about
you
the
said Miss Marvel.
I mean Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't remember Miss Marvel having it.
Yeah, Captain Marvel's crazy. I mean, I like her new costume a lot, but I don't like it with the mohawk helmet, and I don't like it black and white. It just seems weird to me. So
it's weird. I'm not familiar with that look.
It's just weird. It's just
okay. I see. Yeah. It almost looks a little bit like a Spider-Man Venom hybrid.
It's her shield. It's her shield outfit.
I don't like it.
I do like the basic concept of stealth outfits as far back as
me too.
Spider-Man's black costume and of course Iron Man's stealth.
Hey,
suit.
I'm on board for stealth costumes. But I just feel like Captain Marvel.
That one could be better.
When she's meeting up with her idol, I wanted to meet her in a cool, colorful costume that was inspiring to her.
I
think my favorite scene in there was the explanation of how her powers, how she sort of deals with her powers, and Captain Marvel's sort of response to it.
Yeah,
it's just a lot of.
It's really fun. Whether you're reading Captain Marvel or Ms. Marvel, it's really a good read.
Then we have
cheater picks. That's why this is a good week. This is a big week for stuff. So my cheater pick is Infinity Gauntlet number 3, which is
I've been liking this book from the beginning.
I've been liking this book. It's got beautiful art by Dustin Weaver. This issue brings in Drax, and it's old school looking Drax, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, Cape Drax.
And it reveals thing about Thanos that was interesting that he's using one of the Infinity Gems. And the way it's used and the way he has to give it up is very interesting. They bring in a couple more of the Guardians, and the way they do that is really cool.
The Guardians was interesting.
I really like it. This is a family of Novas. They're teamed up with Thanos because they don't know his true deal. They wind up having a run-in with Star-Lord and Gamora and another Guardian. And
is their dog still Nova suited?
Their dog is still Nova suited up, although that's mostly in the background.
Okay.
But it's so good. It's a family adventure comic set against the backdrop of sort of post-apocalypse. It's really great.
I think it's weirdly, it's one of the most, I mean, it's a kind of darker story.
It is.
But it's also one of the most family-friendly books that Marvel's done in a while, in the sense that it is literally about a family.
Yep.
You know, I can the only other time books I can think of that are like that are maybe like Power Pack and to some degree the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, I can see that.
Randy, do you think they're gonna like find a way to continue to use these characters post?
I hope so. I think this is a great character concept
because they seem like characters I'd like to see stick around.
Yeah,
I think we'll be seeing several of them.
Like
maybe in the new Nova Corps. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows?
But instead of being just the mom, I kind of like for it to be
the whole family and the dog. Most importantly, the dog.
Yes. Nick, what's your cheater pick?
My cheater pick is another Secret Wars title. This is the second issue of Civil War.
Which we all loved.
Yeah. It's been really
good. I mean, the first issue was fantastic. It's sort of the greatest hits version of what Civil War should have been.
Yep.
But and also all the extrapolation of what came next.
Yeah, what came next with Secret Invasion and Siege.
Well, and it's an actual...
the whole of America gets divided in between the two sides.
Well, yeah, it's an actual war.
Yes,
right. It is very much a war take on it. Like Steve is a general and Tony is a president, and they have armies. I mean,
and there's questions of like which one of the two has can supply food to the country best, and will they have to make difficult negotiations with them for supplies?
Yeah,
or space to live in.
There's infrastructure as well as the superhero stuff, which I think is interesting.
And the world building by Charles Soule is just amazing.
It really is.
Right, Soule.
I mean, just sort of the depth that we get and the pacing of the book. I actually think that's probably my favorite thing because
that sort of way they intercut between
they intercut, but it doesn't feel like, you know how some comics feel like they're over in 5 minutes?
Right.
This one feels definitively very grand.
Like
it's got some
meat to
yes.
It.
Yeah.
And I just love the interaction between the characters. Their version of Peter Parker is very interesting and a lot different than any Peter Parker than we've seen.
Well, he's a little bit more serious. He's been estranged from his wife and kid for some time.
Right.
Yeah. And he's Tony's second, or Cap's second in command.
Which is interesting. But we get versions of Beast. I love the version of Storm that we see.
Yeah, she was great.
And we have to remember that this is when she was married to Black Panther.
Yep.
And, you know, things have occurred and continued on. So she was still married to him at this point. And... you know, Bucky Barnes is in there, Colossus.
Yep.
I think these are sort of just great versions of characters. I think you put it best, Dave, when there's like, this is sort of a what if, but a what if, like, how did you put it?
Well, you know, one thing that what ifs and Elseworlds can do is that they can show you these kind of edgier scenes with heroes. They can show their lives and deaths sometimes that you couldn't do in a regular book. But they are able to do it without harming the characters within their core existence.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what I said earlier, but that's
I think
kinda,
that's pretty close.
That's kind of what I like about it, is that you get to see very dramatic stories with the characters without really, in a way that's not going to hurt their mainstream incarnations.
I also love the art. Lionel Francis Hughes doesn't always do it for me, but his shot of the Capital of the Blue, which is a big, giant Captain America shield.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And then Alpha, Resilient Alpha, which is the Iron's capital city. It's more high-tech Neo-Tokyo looking.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great looking stuff in here. And they've definitely done sort of a militarized look, especially for the Captain America's folks, which I really like.
You know, the other thing I like, and this is maybe something I mentioned to you, Nick, is that the characters feel more true to me in this than they did in the original Civil War.
Yeah.
Like, their personalities have grown organically out of the conflict, where I feel like often Mark Miller forces characters to jump through certain hoops so he can get his big dramatic moments.
Yeah, Miller's plot-driven, not character-driven. He doesn't care what the characters would or wouldn't do.
Right.
And these feel... I mean, Charles Soule does make
these
it very character-driven.
These feel true to the characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though a lot of them are quite different, but they feel like they've evolved organically.
And, of course, I will not reveal the ending, but that ending is amazing, and I can't wait to see what they do.
These guys are pretty good with their cliffhangers.
Yep. Dave, your cheater pick?
And my cheater pick is also from Secret Wars. This is a second issue of Spider Island. That was a surprise favorite from before.
Yeah, and second issue is really good.
And I go into it not having read the Spider Island story, but very easily able to pick up on the notion that this spider virus has essentially ravaged the land in this. And what do they call the queen?
She's the queen.
Yeah.
She's just the queen, yeah.
Yeah.
Who kind of controls it all, and like basically all the other heroes and people are her minions. They all look like these gross spider people.
Yep.
And there's a sort of small contingent of rebels that are led by like Flash Thompson as Agent Venom.
Yep.
The Vision, Who was it? Like Werewolf by Night?
Capwolf.
Capwolf.
I think in the first issue they kind of...
They extrapolated it from him.
Yeah.
Basically, but it's kind of like the non-human people from Marvel are the people right. that can resist the spider venom.
Right.
Or the spider virus.
Right, so they gave the cult the lizard serum.
Right, and they have all these cool ideas for trying to sort of get other people out of it.
Yeah. What they do to Tony Stark in here is so good.
I haven't read it yet. I'm excited.
Man, it's so good.
I'm just flipping through it. And I actually really do like the original Spider Island story.
I do too.
It was good, but I just haven't read it.
You don't have to have read it to get
this. No, not at all. I think this is easily just you jump right in.
Anyway, without saying too much about it, it continues their fight against the Queen. They've got some big ideas that are kind of like, you know, Hail Mary passes, essentially, mm-hmm. but they rely on some of the same crazy, very Marvel Universe-y tech and wild ideas to potentially try and get some more people on their side. And Christos Gage, the writer, is having a lot of fun
with
the Marvel
Universe.
Who's
doing the art? Is that
Paco Diaz?
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about Spider Island to me is... If you like stories of sort of resistance against an overwhelming force,
yes.
or zombie stories, this feels very much like a zombie apocalypse.
It does.
Just instead of zombies, they're spider controlled drones.
Right. I have to mention one scene. This is a very minor spoiler.
Yeah.
There's an Iron Fist who has been turned into one of these spider drones. He's got six arms, and as he's attacking them, he's like, "Once I had two fists that could become like unto a thing of iron. Now I have six."
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, just like blasting stuff apart with
yep.
it. He's also got this hideous spider head, which is super fun to look at.
Yeah. It's really
like
good.
I feel like Paco Diaz gets to have a lot of fun with all the giant spider faces.
This was a good week for Secret Wars books. And a good week for Marvel in general.
Yeah.
What
else do we have?
Also on my stack for the list, a couple of Secret Wars books. Red Skull number 2, which continues on. That was a really good, surprisingly good first issue. Number 2 is just as good. It's a Magneto Red Skull team up in the Marvel Zombies era. I mean, it's
creepy combo.
It's really good, and it's going to some interesting places. Future Imperfect number 4, which is coming on to the close of that, but it's basically Thaddeus Ross is the Thing teamed up with the Maestro Hulk to deal with Hulk the Troll.
Okay. I know who all those people are, but somehow that still sounded Greek to me.
It's very weird. Star Wars Darth Vader number 8, which is a sort of a heist story with a variety of bounty hunters and really good. Mad Max Fury Road, Max Part 2, which is the last of the Mad Max prequels, I guess.
Have you read that yet, Randy?
Yes, it's good. It's,
the first one was kind of like reintroduced a Thunderdome concept,
yeah.
and tied all the previous Mad Max movies to the to Fury Road.
This involves Max Rokitansky infiltrating the Scorpions. You remember the creepy guys with all their porcupine looking armor?
Yeah, yeah.
Infiltrating one of their underground compounds to find a lost girl.
Nice.
It's really good. Second issue of Brian K. Vaughan and Steve Scroach's We Stand on Guard, which got us into some sort of dark territory. But also as sort of the fun giant
super light. Previously.
No, but they are definitely playing this as a resistance and the U.S. military is evil kind of thing.
Yeah, I think I saw it. Like there's interrogation scenes.
There's interrogations. Yeah, there's definitely a overwhelming force against resistance kind of thing. But there's also fun mecha and giant robots and giant vehicles and stuff like that. The latest issue of Fade Out number 8, which I believe wraps the second part of the story arc. It definitely brings up something big and continues to be
Hollywood
noir. Yeah, man, this is Brubaker and Phillips do noir well, and this is a classic 50s Hollywood noir post blacklisting, all that kind of, or during the height of the blacklisting, that kind of stuff. Really, really good. Then from Boom, this is the number 1 I talked about. There's a book called John Flood, which is about a guy who there was an experiment and he doesn't sleep and now he can see connections other people don't see and he's like a freelance investigator type. A lot like sort of the weird Sherlock in Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about him recruiting his newest ally, who's sort of his physical force, and maybe looking into a weird serial killer story. Interesting art. Reminds me a little of Jaramillo Jr. stuff. Really, really nice. And
serious stuff?
Serious stuff, yeah. It's got a bit of that quirk to it.
Yeah, okay.
But it's written by Justin Jordan, who you might know from The Spread and Luther Strode.
Yeah.
And it's a fun first issue. Finally, there is a new graphic novel series starting up called The Creeps, which is by our friend Chris Schweitzer. You might know him from a variety of cool sketches he's done. He's done sketches for us a few years here at All Ages.
I didn't even see his name on the book when I put it on the shelf. I was like,
but the Krogan.
He also does the Krogan books, which are sort of a historical adventure. Well, this is a, I would say, sort of looks like 80s adventure kind of book. The Creeps are the best and only crime-solving squad at Pumpkins County Middle School.
And really, you likened it to...
I like to see the two sort of Goonies and
Monster Squad.
Monster Squad,
yeah,
kind
just,
of stuff.
Just at a glance, at least.
Yeah. So it's got, they've got a hacker and a monster expert and a gadget whiz and a super ripped fashionista. And it's got really great art from Schweitzer. And this one is called Night of the Frankenfrogs. It looks like fun. Definitely all ages kind of book. Nick, what else is on your stack?
Just a few things that I don't think have been mentioned yet. There was an issue of Guardians Team Up. That hits
Guardians of the Galaxy.
That is actually written and drawn by Javier Pulido from She-Hulk.
Yep.
And that sees sort of Star-Lord teaming up with Spider-Man.
Oh, nice.
It was actually a lot of fun.
Team up and sort of slightly adversarial.
A little bit.
So like old-school team up.
Yeah,
nice.
Old-school team up. And there's a few other guest stars that are kind of fun.
But I think especially for people who enjoy Pulido's art, if you like to go on She-Hulk, if you like that kind of retro vibe in general, worth checking out.
Then I have Guardians of Nowhere, which is, you know, continues Bendis' and Deodato's story in Secret Wars. Also, the second issue of Siege, which I'm curious to see where it goes. The fourth issue of Kaptara,
I forgot Kaptara.
Chip Zdarsky and Keegan MacLeod's insane, crazy book from Image. And then the last one that I... this is just sort of a light Secret Wars book, the giant-sized little A versus X Marvel.
Yeah, Scotty Young's.
But while you were reading it, Nick, I heard you laughing about every 10 seconds.
Well, right. I mean, it's like, it's fun. It's laugh out loud. It's sort of...
Like good light.
Yeah. It's sort of what I would akin to as a kid reading Garfield. It's just sort of comical and fun.
Does anyone at any point talk about hating Mondays?
No.
Does anyone love lasagna?
Sure.
Hey, just out of curiosity, because somehow came up when I was talking to a customer in the store the other day. Like, when I was a kid, I got very into Garfield. I probably had about 9 or 12 of those little
Several
Garfield
of those books, yep.
Books, did you?
Yep.
Nick, did you?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So,
things.
The cover on the AVX is great. It's a couple tree houses and Cap and Cyclops yelling at each other.
And
a big dust-up fight going on underneath them.
Yes, and the big story for this is that there is this small town where they're all kids.
Littleville.
And there is two kids that are twins that aren't anybody,
they're just normal kids,
but the Avengers and the X-Men want them for their clubhouse.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of them trying to swaying them, showing the perks of what each clubhouse has.
Oh, nice.
And of course you get like things like the Danger Room and, the Avengers, of course, have Asgard.
Nice.
You know what I would feel like a traditional allure to joining the X-Men would be, if you were a dude, is that it's Babe City.
It's true.
But if you're a little kid, girls are gross.
That's a downside,
One
Dave.
Of the big things is Iceman makes a roller coaster every day. So I actually think this is just an exercise how much fun Scotty Young can have.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So. And probably like... Parents of kids who have like superheroes or just kind of getting into superheroes, I bet they just love the kids.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and there are a lot of in jokes, sort of what Pixar does that you know longtime readers are going to pick up on and sort of laugh at, but it'll go over kids' heads and just they'll just think it's fun.
David, anything else in your stack?
I've got a handful of other ones. There's the third issue of James Robinson's Airboy.
Yeah,
his kind of twisted bio comic,
deeply profane.
In this case, he and the artist are sort of somehow existing now in the fictional World War II of Airboy, with its like sort of World War II pilot heroes and colorful bad guys and mechs and stuff.
And it's gone full color. That's what's interesting.
Yep, and they've they're sullying it.
Yeah,
it's like they're dirtying it up.
Yep.
There's a book called Dark Corridor from Image that I haven't read yet, but it looks to be kind of a I want to say art house noir.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's about right. Sort of a crime anthology.
Yeah, I feel like artists, people like artists like kind of almost like Charles Burns.
Yeah, that know, kind of stuff.
Like
yeah.
A little more underground art, but also like Javier Pulido. It has some of that look and color.
Yeah.
You should check it out. There's the second issue of Eight House Arc Light.
Speaking of Artie.
Truly strange sci fi fantasy series from Brandon Graham.
Although this isn't him, he's like writing. Curating it, right?
Yeah. I thought he was writing.
Is he actually writing? Oh, okay.
I don't know.
And is this Marion Churchland still on the art?
Yep. No, okay. I believe that to be.
Okay, so Marion Churchland, his girlfriend, is amazing. Or maybe his wife, I'm not sure. But she's great.
I can't find the...
I think it's on the back list. Very back page.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Story and apparently a little bit of art is indeed Brandon Graham.
Oh, okay.
And art and colors, Marion Churchland.
Okay, cool.
And then lastly, there is a graphic novel I want to take a look at called Baba Yaga's Assistant.
Yep.
This looks to be sort of an all-ages book. I see there's a quote on the back from Kazu Kibuishi, one of our favorite
people. Our first all-ages awesomeness guest.
Yeah. He said, well, the notable thing about this is that, it's for one thing, story-wise, it's literally about somebody who I think becomes the assistant to the scary witch-type person, Baba Yaga,
yep.
from Russian mythology and mm-hmm. folklore. But it has art by Emily Carroll of...
Through the Woods.
Through the Woods, which we're reading next week.
Yep.
On the back, I see that Kazu says, Emily Carroll is one of the best artists working today. Her work in Baba Yaga's assistant is at once scary, heartfelt, and elegant in its design. And Hope Larson from the Wrinkle in Time graphic novel says,
yep.
A gorgeous new tale from the land between myth and modernity, childhood and adulthood, where all is lost and everything is possible. Anyway, sounds like it could be fun stuff, and if only for Emily Carroll's art, I intend to check it out.
Very cool. All right, that about wraps up our comics talk for this week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about some TV and movies and more. All right, so this weekend we all got out, not together, but separately to go see Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
You guys yep. left me, so I had to go.
Now. Sorry, somebody had to cover the store, Nick.
I know.
But
somebody's got to go to jail, Nick.
You had to go see it with your wife. I'm
That's
sorry.
It was nice. I had a gift certificate to Alamo Drafthouse, so
yeah.
I got to eat and go see a movie. It was nice.
Yeah. So we all liked it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quick question.
And not just because it was called Rogue Nation. I just want to be clear.
Pantheon of best to worst Mission Impossibles.
Ghost Protocol to the top, and I will brook no discussion.
Okay.
Then for me, Rogue Nation, then 3, then 1, then nothing, then anything else, then 2.
I think that's my list too. Let me just double check. Ghost Protocol... Then
you said 3 might be over Rogue Nation for you, but I don't know on reflection if he's changed your mind.
I feel like I might have liked 3 a little bit better than Rogue Nation, so I'm going to say Rogue Nation number 3.
Protocol.
Ghost Protocol. Then 3. Then Rogue Nation. Then 1. Then 2.
Yeah.
My favorite is still Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
And then Rogue Nation number 1 and the.
Then number 3?
3 all sort of tie. Because I like them
really?
All for
okay.
different reasons.
So you're cheating.
I am cheating.
Well, the whole idea of the series has always been to have a different sort of spin with each new director. So.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll accept your cheater.
Here's one thing I like that Rogue Nation Continues, that Ghost Protocol did. I like the subtitles. I like that it's not just called Mission Impossible 5.
Oh, right. I agree.
Yep.
These are cooler sounding names.
Yeah.
And Protocol sounds cool. Rogue Nation sounds cool.
And I think that helps their franchise, too, because when you get to, it's number 8, you start to question, is this going to be any good? But if it's just a subtitle...
So is that Police Academy's problem? Is that what you're saying?
That's one of their problems. But Police Academy had subtitles. Citizens on Patrol,
oh God,
sir.
They did, didn't they?
Moscow. What was the one? It was the Russian one. They had subtitles,
oh God,
sir.
Right.
That was not their problem.
I completely forgot.
I'm
going to
suggest Mission Impossible Armageddon Incorporated.
That's an excellent. So I thought this one. I mean, like I say, Ghost Protocol was Brad Bird. It was amazing and was sort of a perfect action movie
mm-hmm.
to me. But I thought this did a lot of what Rogue Nation did very well. Brought the team together. Have you noticed that? I think every Mission Impossible movie, it's their last mission or they're on the outs.
Yeah.
Like they've never done one where everything's working fine.
Well, when you kind of begin. With the big reveal that is it
Jim Phelps,
Phelps
yeah.
is the traitor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of establish that these are kind of event driven things.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit, it is a little like the X-Files.
Yeah.
It seems like they were getting shut down every season finale.
Yeah. The funny thing is, it never bothers me, and I think that's because they wrap us into the story so quickly.
Yeah.
Like they've perfected the formula.
Yeah.
Just like Bond opens with a pre-credits sort of action sequence.
Yep.
The Mission Impossible movies
sequence in this one.
Have been doing that since the beginning, right? I don't know if the first one had. I know the second one did.
The first one did.
Okay, yeah. So, but the thing is, usually their pre-credits ties into the ongoing story, whereas Bond is usually at the end of a previous mission
that has
nothing to do with the current story. And I like this better. It's sort of a, we don't know how it ties in, but somehow it ties in.
Well, after we saw it, I like the Daniel Craig Bonds and everything, but I was saying, I like this franchise better than Bond.
This franchise is in better shape.
I think it's overall got a stronger track record.
Yeah.
I think they're different animals. I mean,
they are.
They are sort of action.
Choose your side, Nick. You too, Randy.
Hate it or love it, Nick. Hate it or love it. No, I think you're both right, because Mission Impossible is a stronger franchise, but I think part of that is because it is a franchise. It's not unlike Fast and the Furious. It gets in, it knows what it wants to do, and it does it in sort of formulaic way. Now, I think it's stronger than Fast and the Furious from what I've seen of that, but you guys might argue that. I don't know.
I haven't seen enough of them to quite argue the franchise
as
a whole.
Bond is trying to be a little more arty.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think
also show a little bit more character development.
And I think
days.
To some extent that is a good and a bad. It can be good, and if handled badly, it can be Quantum of Solace.
Right. Well, his character to some degree resists change.
Yeah.
In the sense that Bond is a comfort food.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible movies know their comfort food, and they just run with it.
Yeah.
I think I was telling you, it has become sort of the quintessential popcorn film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very entertaining. It's fun. It's not
a heist Bond.
Yeah.
Everyone is a heist.
Yeah.
I like the sort of the banter the characters have. I think Simon Pegg is great.
Well, you're always going to essentially see them. You know, these guys are experts at getting out of situations. They get into some really complicated ones that they have to get out of. And you know you're going to see them squirm trying to figure it out. It's going to
They've had good scripts. Yeah, I'll come back to that. They've had good scripts. Like Christopher McQuarrie is one of the writers of the script. He's a guy who wrote Usual Suspects.
Right.
They do these crazy like things they got to break into that they only have like the barest millimeter of chance for any kind of failure or anything to go wrong, and they have a fight on they have a fight in the wings of an opera. They have a motorcycle chase on a cliff. They think about cool places to do it.
Right.
It is like a gaming. It's like a role playing game.
It is.
Like the GM thinks of some good set pieces. Puts him in places, and then...
He steers him into it.
Inevitably, Tom Cruise's character fails some roles.
Yeah, that was what you were pointing out, and that is kind of what makes it.
Yeah.
Like, when it gets fun is when they... When the plane is taking off and he is clinging to the side of it.
Something goes wrong. The plan is not working and they have to improvise.
I love that scene.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
It was in all the trailers and stuff.
It's in the first, like, 5 minutes of the movie.
But it is the sort of the payoff to it and stuff.
Yeah.
I honestly think the opera scene was probably my favorite of the entire movie.
It was really good.
I would maybe give it to the underwater or the ghost or the motorcycle race.
The underwater was cool.
But, it's another really good Mission Impossible movie.
I did feel occasionally, regarding the motorcycle chase and a few other scenes, there were times when the bad guys shot so many bullets without hitting that I was getting a little bit of that Bond weariness.
There was
come on.
There was
if
a little bit of that.
Shooting that much, then they're going to need to hit something occasionally.
Yeah.
It's really hard to hit something from firing a moving vehicle.
Yeah, but these guys are—they're always supposed to be experts.
Yeah,
always supposed to be experts.
No, there was a lot of missing going on. It wasn't quite A-Team, but there was a lot of.
I think what I would have done is I would just edit down a little bit, so there's a little bit less shooting, so that you feel like.
Well, that's what I noticed when we came out of it, that there was a lot more shooting in this one.
Right, and you know the first one I remember was sort of remarkable for the fact that the heroes. I believe maybe excepting a single scene did not ever use a single weapon in it.
Right.
And then I'm sure there had to have been guns in John Woo's one, but I haven't seen
there. There were knives and guns.
And I know that like MI3 had, you know, I remember I saw just bits and pieces of it on cable the other day. And, you know, Tom Cruise takes out a couple guys with like an MP5 or something early on. So he's using it, but I think it kind of became on again, off again in the last few movies.
There was a lot more shooting. There was not as much shooting out in Ghost Protocol either. There was a lot of gadgets and that kind of thing. There's definitely shooting. I mean, they're not pretending to be the A-Team here. But this one, I feel like, had the most toward the end where Ethan Hunt just basically shoots up a whole bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more guys shooting back as a result.
They were all bad.
Yeah. No, it's just what Dave was saying is that they all start shooting back, and that means that either someone's got to go down or these guys are the worst shots and you get the Stormtrooper problem.
Right. It's sort of an accepted movie thing.
Yeah.
And as you know, Nick, in real life, it actually is very hard to miss or to hit somebody.
Yeah.
I believe I read somewhere like the number of like spent shell casings in Vietnam is like a trillion, tens of trillions or something.
Yeah, sure.
Like,
just but that doesn't make that for dynamic filmmaking.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have to find that balance. And I just feel like they went just a little overboard in the the bad guys shoot a lot, don't hit much.
But the thing is, like you and Dave, like you and I have discussed before, Dave, if you're buying into the movie, these things don't come up until after when you're discussing it.
Because there was not a big problem.
There's a big action sequence underwater where they're like, you know, there's this super secure facility, and after we left the theater, I was like, I started thinking, is that so secure that they couldn't possibly get use out of it on a daily basis? And it is a plot contrivance that it is so right. hard to get into.
Essentially, it's like a dungeon in an RPG.
Yeah.
It's like
well, who feeds the monsters?
Yeah. But I love that scene.
But if they hooked you into the movie, you're not thinking about it at the time, and they definitely hooked me into the movie.
I love the tech. The tech was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. The tech is great.
I also liked Simon Pegg, before they actually do that infiltration,
yeah.
they imagine an alternate version in which he is more of like the badass in it, and things don't go so well.
And he finally gets to wear a mask.
Yeah, but it's a great little what-if scene.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And I actually thought the villain was good. Sometimes I don't find their villains to be...
He was almost too sympathetic, to be honest. I was like, I can see his point.
A little bit, but he actually resonated a little bit more than some...
That guy had full-on villain voice.
Yeah, he was good. Yeah.
He was I'm creepy, man.
Yes, I
liked Philip Seymour Hoffman. He was very believable.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is honestly my favorite villain.
But he was such a sociopath.
Scary.
Yeah, he was scary.
He was very scary.
This guy's a sympathetic bad guy. I mean, he's going to different extremes, but he's sort of... They're the IMF. They're trying to do a different thing. Yep. So it made sense, and it made for some good moral conflicts. So,
and we also got Alec Baldwin as the
Alec
head
Baldwin,
of CIA.
Yeah, he was great in there. And Jeremy Renner sort of running back channel at the beginning.
Yep.
Yeah, it was...
And a plot twist that was not unlike something in National Treasure 2. I don't want to say what, but it's a kidnapping.
Yep. This was really fun.
Yeah, go ahead and catch it if you have been enjoying this franchise. It's a very good outing in it.
All right, before we get to the other thing that all of us can talk about, I wanted to quick mention something I watched on Netflix. Last week, I think I mentioned BoJack Horseman.
Yes.
This week, I marathoned Wet Hot American Summer, the first day of camp.
About which I've been hearing much.
It's 8 hours, or 8 hours. It's 4 hours. It's 8 episodes, half-hour episodes. It's less than 4 hours. But I watched the whole thing in one day. It is, like BoJack Horseman, star-studded cast. This is a movie from 2001. It's a spoof of all those summer camp movies like, you know, Meatballs and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
It was back 14 years ago. It was when Bradley Cooper and Amy Poehler and Michael Ian Black and all these people were sort of relatively new. They were still in their, like, late 20s playing teenagers. And that was part of the gag, is that they were all playing teenagers.
Uh-huh.
They were the counselors
at
the summer camp.
In the original movie.
So now it's 14 years later. And they're playing teenagers 2 months before, because this is a prequel. So
they're just running with it.
Oh, yeah, they're just running with it. Janine Garofalo is like the camp counselor. She's the camp director in the movie. And she's in this. And then they added...
I haven't seen her in a while.
She's great in this.
Nice.
And on top of all the people they had already... these are all the people, the guys did the State, which was a comedy show on MTV, a sketch comedy show. They wrote it and directed it. On top of all the people they have, they got everybody back. Chris Maloney's in there. They also added some people. Jason Schwartzman is there. Michael Cera does a very, very hilarious bit. John Hamm plays Reagan's personal assassin, the Falcon. Weird Al Yankovic is in.
I haven't seen this per se, but I watched like a, you know, highlight reel of clips or something. It's like 3 or 4 minutes, I think. And it looks really funny.
It's very funny. It's very, in some ways, it's almost what it parodies. It is a summer camp goofball movie.
Right.
And there are times when I wasn't, like, it took me a couple episodes to get into it.
Right.
And I don't love the movie either. I thought the movie was okay. But after I started watching it, I fell completely in love with it. And it is very funny. And it's just a spot the actor too. Elizabeth Banks is in there. It has got a huge cast of funny people doing funny things, and is definitely worth a look, especially if you ever went to summer camp and can relate to this. I didn't, but I watched a lot of summer camp movies.
Ballpark.
So yeah, another thing up on Netflix. Nick, I understand you've been playing a game on your iPhone.
On my iPhone, yeah. No, actually, I don't know how I think I found this. Like, maybe an ad on Facebook, or somebody mentioned it. But this is a companion piece to Fallout. It's called Fallout Shelter, and it's basically just a sim game. You're given X amount of
Fallout game just hit.
No,
it's on its way.
On
a trailer.
Its way. So this is probably a bit of a tie-in. Sort of.
Is it a little ways out?
A few months out, at least.
A few months.
Yeah.
Okay, but yeah, it's like the lead up. It's building up.
Right.
The
and interest. This is really you're just building sort of a sim of a vault. You're building different resources.
They're like hideouts. They're fortresses.
You're building rooms that give you resources like electricity, water, things like that. And you can... You're given X amount of people, and then they have to, make babies so you can get more people. It's got a great sense of humor.
You see, when an apocalyptic mommy and an apocalyptic daddy really love each
other. I mean, that's very true. The cheesy dialogue when they're sort of courting is amazing. It is very, 80s-esque.
The Fallout games have actually always had kind of a sense of humor about them. Of course, there's a lot of macabre humor in it, but there's always been a sense of humor.
Yeah. And you can, send out people out into the barren wasteland of the world of Fallout to gather resources.
Hey, you go out in the barren wasteland.
But you've got your own little Pip-Boy that you can, gives you sort of a rundown of what you need to do each day and gives you... a grade on what you do each day. So it's actually just a lot of fun. I found myself spending, just a few minutes here and there.
One of those weirdly addictive moments.
And it is very weirdly addictive, sort of SimCity, because you're, building people. You can rename people. You can... Yeah. It just gives you a wide variety of things to do for free. I mean, is it
free to play? One of these where you can accidentally get in over your head if you start buying stuff?
Well, the only thing that I've found that you can buy is those little lunch boxes that give you bonus things.
Yeah.
You'll get a power armor or something like that. But there are certain objectives that you can meet each day that actually will give you those as well. So I've never bought anything, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything. So I actually think it's one of those perfect games.
They're not exactly pushing it on you like some games.
And I just think it's a lot of fun for what it is.
We probably have some Fallout players.
I imagine.
And I know John, our other staffer, is playing it. I know Amanda's boyfriend, John, is playing it.
If your name is John and you're not playing this, you're clearly
you're doing it wrong. That's right.
Yes, you're doing it wrong.
Get in line, people.
I'm having a lot of fun with
talking to you, John.
Highly recommend you playing it. So that is all.
All right. The other game, which I highly recommend, you finally picked up but haven't played yet.
Correct. I basically did exactly what you said. I went over, turned on my PS4 last night, trying not to wake up my brand new puppy, which is impossible to do.
Uh-huh.
Downloaded it. And then put it in rest mode. Yeah. And then I saw that it had finished downloading
so
this morning.
So this is the game of the summer. Everybody's talking about this. It was the free game for July on PlayStation Plus. I believe it is no longer free. It probably is a $15 game.
Right.
Totally worth it, by the way. It's called Rocket League Soccer. And all it is it's soccer, but instead of being guys, you are driving around in cars that become more customized. And they can jump. And they have little boosters at the back, which you can use to sort of boost and go faster. And you're basically... knocking the ball, this giant ball around a field,
how
trying to get in your goal.
Is it?
Giant. The ball
big
is
as a car.
Big as a monster truck. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You get as you win, you get more stuff. You get hats and helmets for your car. You get designs.
Said a hat?
Yep, hats
for your car.
I have a taxi cab topper and a pizza topper. I've also got a sombrero, Viking horns. You can change out all
this
stuff.
It's got some of the craziness of the game series, the more violent, I presume, game
metal,
Carmageddon.
Yeah,
which led to what I consider the greatest video game title of all time. Carmageddon 3, Carpocalypse Now. But they did have crazy stuff put in there.
And this is you can boost and smash into opposing players and explode them for a second. But there's also, it's soccer. You're trying to knock the ball into the goal. It's hard to figure out the physics of it. You can drive and boost and drive up the enclosed arena and drive on the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of, it's very addictive.
I've seen you post a few videos.
It's very addictive and fun and simple to play. Me and my kids play it. It's got a lot of multiplayer. You can play online or play multiplayer in person with split screen, or you can do both. I've played where I play me and my son playing against a couple of friends online, and you play four versus four on four, and we all played together versus four computer players.
Okay.
So it's a blast. I definitely recommend it. You've probably seen a lot of articles going up about Rocket League Soccer, but definitely
somebody
worth...
had told me that the inexpensive game of the summer would be one in which cars knock around giant soccer balls. I would have said liar. But I wrong.
This is also on Steam, by the way, for all you PC gamers. I don't know if it's on any other consoles, but I know it's on Steam as well.
Well, you're not playing Arkham Knight. Maybe you can play this.
That's right. Exactly. Well, you can play Arkham Knight. You can play as Alfred now.
That's true.
I mean, until the computer crashes. But you did see that, right? The mod that somebody made.
I posted that one.
Yeah.
Essentially, you can have Alfred as the skin for Batman, which is the videos of this that are out there are hilarious and awesome. Alfred is opening up the biggest can of whoop-ass ever.
He's ex-SAS, you know, he's got some skills.
And looking, of course, dignified as hell the whole time.
All right. Finally, the show that we talked about when it first started up, we've watched, I think, 4 episodes of before the big twist.
Right.
And Wayward Pines, which has concluded its 10-episode run. Yeah. Nick and I caught it as it came out. Dave, slowpoke that he is, finally caught up.
I was getting there. yeah, so we have all seen it. Now, before we
talk
about it...
So this is our last topic. So if you have not seen Wayward Pines, you want to watch it, we're going to do spoilers, so stop listening now.
Broadly speaking, we enjoyed it.
We enjoyed it. Come back next week for the podcast. Yo, and Yo-Jo. For those of you still around, spoiler territory for Wayward Pines. Let's go.
Okay. Because Wayward Pines had big, mega spoilers.
Big twist. Well, episode 5 was called The Truth.
Right.
And involved them telling the kids, the first generation, that there were monsters outside and...
And the year was actually 4025?
Yeah, the year was 4025.
I did.
The year was 4025. It was post-apocalyptic, not creepy Twin Peaksy.
Right, and they had been, a lot of them, basically everybody had been in some kind of suspended animation and ended up in sort of a end times, last ditch attempt to keep civilization going. Because humanity had descended into these sort of like the Morlocks and the Time Machine.
But scarier
and feral.
Yeah.
They looked like creepy albino feral monsters.
They were abnormals. They called them Abbeys, which is not the scariest name for a monster.
But I got used to it they became scary within the context of the show.
And they were all, this was all the project of a madman named David Pilcher, who sort of saw this disaster coming and
was always like, is he madman or savior?
Yeah, and started putting people in suspended animation. First volunteers.
Started a cult.
Yeah, first volunteers, and then later, not so much volunteers.
However, when you do see the rest of the world in glimpses, it is a shattered, dead thing that where
he was right about that.
Right, so he is correct. And then the story's moral conundrum is, of course, relating to, well, is he right to do what he does? Is the surveillance and the draconian laws of
security versus free will?
Right, security versus free will is definitely the theme of the show. And ask some reasonable questions.
And then in the last couple episodes descends into kind of cartoonish supervillainy.
A little bit.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I like this show a lot, but I did feel like there were times when things were a little hacky and cartoony. Like his son happens to be in the truck where the bomb goes off.
The series has always, from the beginning, I would say it was actually a little hacky.
Yeah.
In that sort of sense, like not a terrible sense. Just it's a little predictable.
Yeah.
The dialogue never rises above a certain level of fun. It's fun writing.
Yeah.
This is really a series that I think if you like sort of paranoia stories or even like somewhat apocalyptic stories, you're gonna want to watch it kind of for the themes and stuff that you like, not for the great writing.
No. But
the
it all
not terrible.
The one thing I'll say, unlike something like Lost or a lot of the X-Files, a lot of these ones with mythology. Because it was contained, it all sort of made sense. There wasn't a lot of loose ends that I thought were like, why didn't this happen?
There were a few oddities that I found.
Yeah?
Mainly one of the biggest one was
the nurse?
The sister.
Well, that's a character. There are character inconsistencies.
Yeah, that was the biggest character inconsistency that I found. Because
she was pretty much evil at the beginning.
Yeah, she was very evil, and then she became very sympathetic about halfway through.
Well, and Pilcher, the same way. The Pilcher, they couldn't decide whether he was a savior or a madman.
When you were, you might have been while you were out at lunch. Did we talk about this, Randy,
separately?
We talked
a little bit about it.
So I did have the notion that, if I was looking to justify it, this is like me winning in Marvel, no prize. It's not necessarily there in the story.
Yeah.
But if I were to try and justify her character change, I would say, as you had suggested early on, Nick, everybody went a little bit crazy. They've all been confined. In this bizarre, bizarre little...
And she knew the whole deal, so...
And she knew the whole deal, but I don't think she knew about the resistance. She didn't know quite what the extremes her brother would go to.
Yeah.
And so I think it might be... You could say her humanity reasserted itself when she saw hope for a vision that was not his.
Well, I guess it took basically Pilcher sort of reinstating the putting people in cryo sleep.
Yeah.
Like, their people.
Well, and just burning the whole thing to the ground.
Well, and that, too.
I mean, Ethan talked about him being sort of a... Wasn't it Ethan? That was his name? Berth?
Yeah, Ethan Burke.
Yeah. Talked about him sort of being a control freak. And I'm like, yeah, that is basically it. It's like, he wants to save the world, but he only wants to save the world the way he wants to save the world.
Yep. It's a little bit like, you know, every Bond villain, or many Bond villains, yeah. have some sort of utopian plan where they, he'll, like, kill 99% of the population, but a few of his select ones will live in biodomes on the moon or something.
Yeah, yeah.
This is kind of asks, what would it be like to wake up and find out you're living in that villain's biodome?
Yeah, that's true, actually. no, not so much. The character stuff is a little weak, but as far as the structure of the plot, like, the questions of, well, why are they all waking up? How come we can't get out of town? What's going on?
What's the deal with the kids?
Yeah. That stuff all makes sense. It all tracks together, which is a rarity in this kind of thing. Sure. Usually there's some kind of thing where, like, wait, that doesn't track.
Most of the questions they did ask, they answered,
yeah.
Which is good.
And there might be a few small ones, but I feel like they're ones that could be reasonably, you know, like, you kind of wondered, well, why that particular sort of idyllic little small town?
Yeah.
It's because it's what Pilcher wanted.
Yeah.
You know, he's a control freak, and so he was just going for what his sort of vision
was. That was
of
his utopia.
Town.
Yeah. I liked it. I'm not 100% sold on the sort of the final twist where they clearly change things from the books.
Do we know that they clearly changed things?
No, I just have seen people's reactions, it seems like.
I've seen a few negative reactions, but I thought that might just be well, the characters have gone through a lot. We've been with them for, like, you know, 9 or 10 hours, and not giving them a clear-cut victory kind of feels, you know, yeah. you're kind of like, oh.
Yeah. Well, it just seemed like things were not going their way for the first interaction. Like, for that to happen, a lot of, like, there's definitely, that's the story. Like, how did that happen? That's their flashbacks if they do a second season.
What happened?
How did the first generation take over?
Right.
Because they were not in any kind of power position at that point.
They had like tons and tons of guns and stuff.
Yeah, but there were like 6 of them.
Yeah, that's true.
More than that.
Whether that, I don't know. I just, it seemed like for them all to be on board the evil plan.
The kind of punch that they wanted it to have.
Yeah.
It did kind of have to happen off screen and abruptly.
Yeah, agreed.
Although, kind of, the method by which it happened with his, I can only say, slightly doofus kid.
Yeah.
He's like looking down and, you know, would be like an emotional scene. And then like a rock hits his head.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, you doofus.
Yep.
You can't even watch your dad get blown up without a rock hitting you.
Yeah. That's the thing. There was a lot of contrivance to get to that point, I thought. Right. And
but I was having fun the whole time. The reveals were fun. The monsters were creepy. They got to see a lot of monster fight in action and decent special effects in that final episode.
Well,
those dudes got their heads shotgunned off.
What we talked about post or off mic, Dave, was that we're not sure what they do with the second season. Like, the ratings were good, so of course they're going to do a second season. But the whole pitch for this, the showrunner when his ATX Fest talked about this was a closed ended story. Like, it was a whole story that, you know, if they did more, he didn't know what they'd do. That, you know, maybe they would. But
then the ratings started coming.
Then the ratings came in, and they obviously were like, oh, let's set it up. And I feel like, I don't know. We were talking about, like, what are the questions of the second season? They've revealed everything.
Right. Well, you know how, like, the dollhouse kind of did reveal other dollhouses?
Yeah, yeah.
If you found out that Pilcher was not so, you know, basically you've only seen the terrain for, like, maybe a few, you know, 20, 30, 40 miles around them is really all we've actually glimpsed. There could be other pockets of civilization. There could be questions about whether you should reunify with them or not, whether they're better or worse than Wayward Pines.
Right, right.
It does seem like right now the doofus son is the protagonist, and I don't think
that's workable.
I don't think that's workable.
Maybe he'll get hit by another rock.
It was like, that's the start of the first episode of season 2. He's like, my name is Ben, and I, boom, and then a rock hits him, and then it just switches to
a
different narrator.
Truck drives by and knocks a rock into his head. I like it. Well, I would say, although the kid did, I would say did a decent job of playing a sullen, annoying teenager.
Yeah.
Where it might be interesting,
although his rousing speech at the hospital was not so rousing.
Not so rousing. It was not Independence Day.
It was not.
You know, he does not strike me as the leader his father is. He is like the only, and am I right? He's like sort of the only obvious sort of rebel type person in town right now.
Yeah.
So what if, like, years go by and he is not able to find some way out of the situation and he just has to acclimate to it?
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, what you get is what happens when other survivors find Wayward Pines or whatever. And,
right.
Or maybe even like you, because they've got a crazy timeline. What if you jump forward 100 years?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, everything's different. Find out what, you know, what happened. Did they eventually become expansionist? Are they making their first forays out into the world to take down the...
What if they jump forward, like, 500 years and the Enterprise lands?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, it's Earth all along.
And then they're like, look out for that rock.
and then Chekhov throws a rock at the kid.
Got him, kicked him. That said, I kind of like the twist at the end. It was a little bit dark. I understand that why some people might have been a little bit upset.
Well, it was essentially the villains won.
Yeah.
And the one that I felt like it was in such a way that the heroes, barring our sacrificial victim, many of them were still at least alive.
Possibly. Or hung.
That's true. I thought they mentioned a lot of them being in cryo.
Yeah.
Whatever,
so yeah. Yeah.
I assume most of them were in cryo.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't say I'm particularly looking forward to the second season of this, but I like this season quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, the same showrunner comes back. I don't know if Shyamalan's involvement.
Shyamalan has involvement. That makes me nervous.
Yeah, I know. I think I read the same article you did. Yeah. That was an interview with both of them.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% certain on that, but
we probably all give it a try.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
sure.
I'm going to go see the new Shyamalan movie whenever that comes out.
I might.
The Visit.
If I hear good reviews.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll probably keep my eye on the reviews at least a little bit.
I think
bit.
It looks fun.
Yeah.
But
the trailer's been good.
Over. I feel like there's some story we're not thinking of that is actually could really be good.
Maybe
this.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I think if one turned it over a little bit, you have to find it sort of a different theme.
Yeah.
They explored the freedom versus security thing pretty fully in this. And I think you would definitely need to find some new theme and maybe take it somewhere else.
I think you guys are underestimating the importance of rocks being thrown. I think that's going to be a key element of second season.
I'm sure.
Every episode he gets hit by a new rock and wakes up 100 years later. He's the Rip Van Winkle of the future.
He's the Rip Van Winkle of getting hit in the head with rocks.
Rock Van Winkle.
Yeah.
Oh. Mission Impossible, Rock Van Winkle. All right, and on that note, we will see you next week.
Yeah.
Yo, Joe! And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.